Chapter 21. They drove back to the Salzkammergut Lake District and found the one restaurant nearest to Lake Toplitz. The woman at the door looked up with alarm when all six of them stampeded inside. "Pardon me," Quentin said to her. "I know this is a strange question, but is there someone here who might know where Goering's old villa was located?" She tilted her head in confusion as she tried to decipher what she was being asked. The professor stepped up and asked the question again in perfect German.
"Ah, die Villa. Das ist lange her," she said. "Wir versuchen zu vergessen."
"It was a long time ago," the professor translated for everyone else. "We try to forget." "Tell her we understand how she feels," Quentin said, "but it's very important." The professor talked to the woman again. This time a more extended conversation that he didn't bother to translate. "She and her husband have owned this restaurant for almost 40 years, the professor finally said to the others. "They've never heard anyone ask about Goering's villa. But her mother grew up around here, and if there's anyone who would know, it would be her." "Where is she?" Quentin asked. "Can we talk to her?" "We're about to," Lewis said. "But we should know that her mother hated Goering. We've been warned." The owner took the whole crew to the back of the restaurant, where an old woman was sitting at a corner table by herself, cutting into a Viennese Apfelstrudel. The woman looked up demurely at the half-dozen strangers who were interrupting her meal, until the owner whispered something into her ear. The mother's demeanor changed instantly. She said the single word, "Goering," looking like she would have spit if she was sitting anywhere else but in her daughter's restaurant. Nick nudged Lewis forward. "Do your thing, Prof." The professor bowed to the old woman, then started apologizing in German. His sincerity seemed to cut through the hostility, and after a few more proclamations and dramatic hand gestures, she appeared to tell him something useful. He thanked her profusely. "I think I learned a few new German profanities," he said on their way back to the vehicle. "Well, that's a very colorful woman." "Did you happen to learn anything else?" Nick asked.
"Yes. I also learned where to find Goering's old villa."
They took the access road back to what passed for a small town between the two lakes, and then took another narrow, winding road up into the hills overlooking Toplitz.
"I should have written this down," Lewis said, looking out his window at the occasional farms and outbuildings.
They finally came to what looked like an old stone fence, and the professor told them to turn. The vehicle rumbled down an overgrown dirt driveway that probably hadn't been used in decades, until they came to a stop at what might once have been called a villa. It would now more accurately be called a pile of rotting lumber and a half-fallen-over stone fireplace. They all got out to look around. With the van turned off, it was eerily quiet. Kate walked down what was once the front walk, stones set into the ground, now cracked and barely visible through the thick weeds. Nick came up next to her and stood looking at the piles of rotten wood.
"It's like time is trying to erase the memory," he said. "How would anyone even know that a man like Goering lived here?"
"They sure didn't turn it into a museum, did they?" Kate said. "I read somewhere that Hitler's bunker got plowed over and they intentionally kept the location as secret as possible. They didn't want certain people to turn it into a shrine." Kate nodded. There wasn't much else to say. "I don't see a well around here. Do you?" she asked.
"No," he said, "but there must have been one. How else would you get water to the building?"
Jake and Quentin had split off to search the rest of the cleared area around the villa site. Duckworth and the professor were doing the same, in the opposite direction. "There's no gravity feed up here on the cliff," Kate said, looking around at the weeds and the wreckage. "How far could they pump water back then?" Nick and Kate circled the pile of wood, then started picking through the old boards, on the off chance that the well had been dug inside the villa. "I found something here," Nick said, kicking at several planks that were embedded into the ground. Kate came over and together they pried them up,
but found nothing underneath but the stony ground. "You couldn't dig a well here," she said, "even if you wanted to." "You're right." "No. Listen to what I'm saying. You can't dig a well right here." She looked around at the dense forest that surrounded the villa site. "Come on," she said. Nick followed her as she walked a wide circle around the clearing, peering into the dense underbrush. When he understood what she was doing, he started advancing into the brush, moving aside the vines and stinging nettles. A few minutes later, Nick pushed away a thick mound of leaves and saw something that made him stop. "I think we might have something," he said to Kate. "Over here," she yelled to the others. A minute later, they had all made their way through the brush and were looking down at another pile of rotting wood. "There was a structure here," Nick said. "This big beam has some old hardware on it." He bent down and pushed aside the vines to reveal a rusted old bracket and a massive chain. "Look at this thing. Do you really need something this massive to bring up a bucket of water?" They all started clearing the area. Under any other circumstances, they would all be swearing at the thorns and stickers that jabbed at their hands. They'd stop and insist on sturdy work gloves before touching another vine. But today, in this moment, on the top of a hill in northern Austria, five men and one woman did not care about thorns so sharp they drew blood. "There's a platform down here," Nick said. Together they lifted off the great crossbeam and put it aside, then pulled up the centerboard of the platform. "Careful," Jake said. "This thing could collapse at any moment." Nick took out his flashlight and shined it down into the hole. The well was maybe 30 feet deep. It was lined with stones, and it was dry. There was no gold to see. "We should go get some rope," Jake said. "This chain looks sturdy enough," Nick said. "Help me tie it to something." The two men untangled the great chain, wrapped one end around the nearest sturdy tree, and fed the other end down into the well. There was just enough play to reach the bottom. "I don't know about this," Quentin said to Nick. "There might be one last booby trap down there." "I'll be careful," Nick said. He grabbed on tight to the chain and lowered himself into the well. There were countless spiderwebs all around him, but he brushed those aside. One hand over another, he descended to the bottom. Kate leaned over to look down at him. "What do you see?" Nick was busy sweeping the dirt away from something on the bottom of the well. "There's a pair of iron rails," he said, "like railroad tracks, and an old wooden door." There was a long silence as they absorbed what they had just heard. "Can you open the door?" Kate asked. Nick took a deep breath, grabbed the old iron latch on the door, and pulled. It came off right in his hand. He looked at it for a moment, then at the door, and then he said, "What the hell?" and gave it a good kick. The old wood cracked where it was joined to the hinges, and the whole thing fell over with a crash. "Nick!" Kate yelled. "What happened?" There was a long beat of silence as Nick turned on his flashlight and took a few steps through the doorway. When he reappeared, he looked up toward the mouth of the well, brushing dirt from his face. "You all need to come down here," he said. "I think it's safe." Kate climbed down the chain first. When she hit the bottom of the well, Nick wrapped his arms around her. "What's inside?" she asked, peering through the doorway into the darkness. "We're all going to find out together." Quentin came down next, then Duckworth, further trashing his doctor's orders. That left Jake and the professor on top. "I'll give you a hand," Jake said.
"Are you serious?"
"You were kidnapped and taken into the desert," Jake said. "This is nothing. And besides, think how much better the book will be."
"Quite right."
Lewis took Jake's hand and carefully lowered himself onto the chain. Nick and Quentin were waiting at the bottom for him. There was barely enough room for the five of them to stand. But a minute later, Jake climbed down and they all had to squeeze against the filthy walls. But Nick was right. There was no other way to do this. Leading with their flashlights, the whole team stepped inside. It was hard to make out the exact dimensions of the space they were in, but it was immense. The floor sloped downward immediately, the rails leading down to the rest of the cavern. They followed the rails down to the lower level and found the rail car resting there, like something out of an old mine. They kept shining their lights in every direction around them, until the beams all came together, revealing the same thing. Gold bars. Rows and rows of countless gold bars, stacked onto wooden pallets. "Oh my God," Quentin said, looking all around him. "Oh my God." Those were the only words said for a full minute, as every member of this team stood transfixed, shaking their heads in absolute wonder. Their reverie was shattered by the sound of two great boots landing on the stone bottom of the well. A large body wedged itself through the doorway. They all turned to shine their lights on Franz. He was wearing the burned remnants of his desert camo. All of his hair and his eyebrows had been singed off. It accentuated the partial right ear, the scar visible across his left eye now that his eye patch had been burned off, and as he smiled, his missing two front teeth. Franz wasn't carrying a firearm, but neither was any member of the team at the moment. All they had were knives and well-trained fighting skills, and a 6-to-1 numerical advantage. Not nearly enough. "Franz," Kate said, stepping forward. "What are you doing?" Nick whispered to her. Kate put up a hand to hush him, took another step closer to the behemoth. "That's your name, right? Franz?" Franz nodded. "Egar is dead." Franz didn't react. "The Brotherhood is dead. And all of this gold," she gestured to the rose behind her, "it belongs to the people it was taken from." Still nothing from Franz. "I'm sorry we threw you out of a train," she said, "and buried you in an avalanche, and made you flip a burning dune buggy on yourself, and made you fall off the Eiffel Tower," Nick said. Kate waved a hand at him. "You shot him, too," he said to Kate, "plus that hand grenade we tried to blow him up with." Kate turned around and glared at him. "Really, Nick?" "You shouldn't have done those things," Franz said, in perfect English. Kate turned back to him, shocked. "But I understand," Franz said. "I was trying to kill you." "Yes," Kate said, tentatively. "But now, you said Egar is dead." "He is." "May I see his body?" Kate hesitated. "That's going to be difficult." "He blew himself up in the lake," Nick said. "The fish would be eating the pieces right now if the fish weren't all dead, too." Kate closed her eyes. "So help me God, Nick." "Egar is dead," Franz said, mostly to himself. "Egar is dead." They all waited to see what would happen next. And what happened was the same moment experienced by the guards at the castle when Dorothy melted the Wicked Witch of the West. "Egar is dead," Franz said once more, and this time he smiled a big, gap-toothed smile. He looked around at the vast quantity of gold and said, "There is much work to be done here. I am very strong, and I will help you."